Hello, podcast listeners. This is Rob again, and I'd like to ask you for a favor. As I often say, our mission here at Amplify Process Safety is to save lives by helping companies improve their process safety programs. However, we can only meet our mission by working with more companies, and that's where you come in. If your company needs a PSM audit, or perhaps needs help with a process hazard analysis, or maybe you don't know how to submit an RMP plan to EPA, let us know. These are all things that we can help with. At Amplify Process Safety, we are experts in all aspects of PSM and RMP regulations, including PHAs, mechanical integrity, management of change, and we also have lots of useful knowledge related to NFPA requirements, combustible dust, etc. So if you or someone at your company could use our help or just wants to talk about some things related to process safety, please don't hesitate to reach out. Whenever you want to, you can reach me on my direct line, 207-229-0862. And as I said, if you know of anyone who can use our services, please let us know. Till next time, be safe out there.
Welcome to Amplify Your Process Safety, the podcast that provides the experience and expertise you need when it comes to process safety and risk management. Our hands-on approach will give you the insight needed, whether you're new to industry or process safety, in a role where you interact with aspects of process safety, or an experienced process safety professional. Join us in our mission to protect people, the companies they work for, and the communities where they operate by making process safety knowledge available to all.
Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome back to the Amplify Your Process Safety podcast. I'm John Doan. Thank you for joining us today. For this episode, I'm joined by one of the members of the Amplify team, Molly. How's it going?
I'm doing all right.
Very nice. So for today's topic, we're going to dive into a scary event that occurred near my hometown in the spring of 2022 and its relevance to process safety. So on April 29th, 2022, it was a Friday because I remember being out and about, a EF3 tornado touched down for about 20 minutes, just 10 miles east of Wichita, Kansas. Let's start off with Molly. Are you in Tornado Alley or do you have any experiences with tornadoes?
Actually, yes, I'm in the St. Louis area and we do occasionally get tornadoes here as well. In fact, one back in 2011, April 23rd, 2011, went through town and did significant damage to the Lambert Airport here in town. So I'm very familiar with tornadoes.
All right. If you're not familiar with tornadoes, tornadoes are pretty much a weather disaster, natural disaster, where a large spiraling wind column or vortex kind of just rips up areas with high wind. And they're usually rated on what they call the EF scale or the Enhanced Fujita scale, which kind of just rates how violent or aggressive the tornado is. And then the scale is from a 1 to 5, and it's usually based off of wind speed. So going from EF 0 is 65 to 85 miles per hour. And then on the high end, it's just EF 5 is north of 200 miles per hour. Mm-hmm. So the one that
could be pretty destructive.
Oh, yeah. Because the one I saw from a distance or went through town was an EF3. So that was probably between 136 and 165, somewhere in there. How big was the one in St. Louis?
It looks like it was maxed out in an EF4 range briefly, but it was down to about EF2 by the time it hit the airport.
Okay, but still,
yep,
that's pretty large or pretty extreme damages is what they'll consider EF4, but still pretty violent, just having something north of 150 miles per hour kind of going through your area. And the destructions are pretty bad, just to collapse houses. I think at least in Andover, Kansas, we had a lot of collapsed houses. A YMCA was damaged. I think the cars in the parking lot ended up going into the building. So it's some force to kind of be aware of.
Indeed. Yes.
Yeah. And then what they usually do is, you know, the weather people or the meteorologists are aware of tornadoes going on, and they'll probably prompt the county to either sign the sirens or tell you if it's a tornado watch, tornado warning on the news. You kind of just have to be aware of it.
Right. Those terms sometimes get confusing. So when it comes up with a tornado watch, it means that the conditions are ripe for a tornado, but it may or may not happen. But you should be cognizant of your surroundings, watch the weather, and so forth. And those tornado watches tend to be, you know, maybe several hours in duration or whole evening or something like that.
They're very frequent too.
Yes. In our part of the country, yes, we often see tornado watches. But the ones you really need to be careful of are when the Weather Service issues a tornado warning, which means either they've detected a tornado on a Doppler radar, or there's been a trained spotter who has seen a tornado, and that means that it is happening, it's in the area. Those are tend to be smaller geographical area and a smaller time window. Sometimes they're 20 minutes, maybe an hour long type of thing. And when you hear the tornado warning, that's when you actually need to take action and get yourself to a safe location.
Yeah, for sure. And the other warning signs they have, if you're not paying attention to maybe the radio or the TVs, is just the county sirens. I know my county probably does it, I think every Monday at noon, or I've noticed it on Monday at noon. So just being cognizant of when you hear that, it's like, it's probably serious unless it's daylight and Monday at noon.
Right. Yeah, don't get fooled by the drill, but be aware of it and know when the drills are happening so that you can get familiar with the sound of those sirens.
Oh, for sure. And that kind of comes back to, at least when you hear the sirens, knowing what you need to do. So growing up in Kansas, the school I went to was fairly new, so that every time we did the tornado drill, you know, similar to the fire drill, the drill was, all right, all the guys in the middle school hall, we go to the men's bathroom, all the girls go to the girl. No, I think I'm mixing it up. I think it was classes that went to just one bathroom, another class went to another bathroom, but those bathrooms were designed to be a storm shelter. And then the teachers do a head count there, and you kind of wait it out until they said the tornado was over and we went back to class. How did you guys do it?
In our area, generally people would go to interior hallways, and they just have all the kids line up in the center hallways and get down on the ground, put their hands over their head, and so forth. We didn't have any particular safe rooms that I can recall. In your own house, it's good to have some notion as to where you want to go. Ideally, if you've got a basement, which are very common in the Midwest, go down to the basement where it's underground, protected by earthen berms on the outside, if possible. If you don't have that, then you need to get yourself to an interior room. Bathroom is a good one. Someplace without windows that's interior to the house. No outside walls, if possible.
Yeah, so definitely growing up in the Midwest, I think we do a lot of those drills. You're aware of it, and they definitely teach in grade school and going, this is what you need to do. So it's as common as fire drills out here in the Midwest.
Oh, certainly. Yes. Yeah. Yes, indeed. And then even in industry, when I graduated college and started into the work world, there would periodically be tornado drills, even at some of the companies that I worked with.
Oh, nice. At least for me, paying attention to those drills, it's always nice, because I haven't done the interior hallway drill in probably a few decades. I say a few, like maybe two decades, but it's nice to know that most companies or most institutions are building storm shelters, or at least shelter in place buildings, where they're designed for a strong gust of wind or something like that. So knowing the muster points is pretty important, and just knowing what the company's emergency response plan is, especially if you're in a plant or in a facility that has other chemicals going on. So let's just transition into that and just talk about, you know, muster points, emergency planning response, especially towards natural hazards or natural disasters that occur. So probably the first one we probably talk about is just maybe what do you do for a process side of it? Do you shut down? Would you keep it going?
Yeah, so it's going to kind of depend on your process, what the hazard is, how much warning do you have. But that should all be laid out in your emergency response plan. But you need to consider what happens if your operators, for instance, can't continue to shelter in the control room. You know, how do they shut that down if they have to leave the location? And then also, a lot of times there's like a fire explosion. You want people to maybe evacuate the plant. And so there are a lot of muster stations set up at the plant fence lines and things of that sort. However, if you're talking a natural disaster like a tornado, the last thing you want people to do is to go outside and stand by the fence.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that makes no logical sense to do that. So you need to have alternatives and alternate muster stations that are safe shelters where you can say, okay, if this type of siren goes off, then you need to go to the basement of this building or the control room or whatever other sturdy structures you have around for gathering instead of your evacuation muster station that may be at the plant gate.
And I've also seen it in some places where in their SOP, they'll have it under like emergency operations. And for inclement weather, depending on where they're at, they're probably more prone to, let's say, flooding, you know, not be like a major flooding, but let's just say a poor draining and that just, you know, floods in the area. So they may have an emergency operations on how to operate while there is a flood coming or there's high water. So it's just nice to have that already laid out so that your guys are aware of what to do when that occurs instead of kind of panicking and having to find the SOP to figure out what they need to do.
Yeah. Interesting when you mention flooding. I mean, we get some flash floods, some flooding in this area, but perhaps not quite as frequent as tornado watches and warnings. But some places do see a lot more of the flooding type of thing, earthquakes. One example of that was back in Japan several years ago with the Fukushima nuclear plant, where they had an earthquake which triggered a tsunami and subsequent floods. And unfortunately, they weren't prepared for it. They had some backup generators, but they were in a basement, which ended up getting flooded. So keep those sorts of things in mind, not just from your emergency response plan and evacuation, but also for your design of making sure that you've got equipment that's necessary located in a position where it's not going to be damaged by these natural disasters.
And definitely just maybe talk about it or evaluate it. Because sometimes when you're in a group and you go, hey, is this possible? And like, nah, it's not possible. And then it ends up occurring. You're like, we did talk about that and we didn't do anything about it.
Right.
Especially when it comes to tornadoes or floodings or something that's just very once in a blue moon, maybe one in 20 years.
Well, earthquakes is another one like that. Usually when you talk about earthquakes, a lot of times people think of California, but actually there is a large fault running through the Midwest in the St. Louis area. And so we are in a earthquake zone that we need to be aware of and prepared for should something like that happen. So it's something that a lot of parts of the country need to be cognizant of and take into account in their emergency response plans. So when we talk about facility siting, we often review that during a PHA. And a lot of times there are general questions, as you said, you know, you might bring up earthquakes and things of that sort in a PHA, and people say, no, that can't happen. But you do need to consider topics along those lines, whether it be tornadoes or floods, those sorts of things. Some specific items to consider are if you have glass windows, making sure that those are not going to shatter in a tornado and injure any employees or allow additional shrapnel and things to come into the building. We talked a little bit about low points. Not only do you not want your equipment put in a low point that could be subject to flooding, but you also don't want your muster points down there. So if you're directing people to a basement, you need to make sure that it's not going to get flooded out.
The other one I think about when it comes to low points are just like if you have heavier than air gases that might be floating around. I know out in oil and gas industry, H2S is a concern. They usually pool up in low-lying areas. So you would hate to have a group of people just, you know, waiting for the emergency to be over or the drill to be over, and you accidentally have gas drifting in that direction because it's a low point.
Right. Right. So lots of things to consider when you're making your emergency response plans. And the PHAs are a good opportunity to talk about those topics. In fact, the EPA recently proposed some changes to the RMP, Risk Management Plan standard, which would require additional reviews during a PHA for natural hazards and power loss.
Yeah. It could be power loss. It could also be loss of fuel gas or other utilities. But like that big freeze they had in Texas, maybe what, 2 years ago? It feels like two years ago. But that one, just imagining, you know, if you just lost your fuel gas or you lost your power because they have to redirect the power and you can't really run your plant. So it's a good area or a good opportunity to talk about it, especially when you have a diverse group at your PHA, when you have operations, if you have engineering. You have safety, you might have maintenance, but when you have that group, it's nice to kind of ask that questions, and you sometimes get a variety of different answers. So you have an idea of what they think the emergency response plan is, or, you know, if they're consistent, you're like, oh, these guys know what they're talking about, but you see different like aspects of what they're supposed to do. So it's, it's nice to talk about, muster points, emergency response plans in those settings.
Right. So what do we do when it comes to drills? We talked about a few drills, you know, growing up in school and things like that. But what should companies be doing with regard to drills, emergency response?
They should definitely be doing it at least once a year. The tricky part is you have, you know, your operations on road, you know, maybe on a schedule that they might not always be there. So you might not get all of them. Contractors might not be, you know, in the loop on that one. But it's the importance of having a drill is to kind of just get that practice in and knowing where you need to go, where you should, what you should be doing, because hearing it's one thing, but when you actually practice it and kind of do it, muscle memory kind of kicks in.
Right. And sometimes those drills bring up gaps. You know, if, for instance, you have somebody that's normally in an office building, but sometimes is out in the manufacturing area, and the drill takes place when they're in the manufacturing unit, well, they're going to evacuate with those folks, but they need to be aware that they're not going to be in their building office for that headcount. And how do you pair up those headcount tallies when somebody is maybe in a different place than normal? Yeah. And so those drills are a nice way to check out glitches like that that might come up.
Yeah. The other one I've seen is, if they're doing like road work or some major road work and that redirects a lot of people's evacuation, how do you let people know, hey, this road's closed because they're doing work or maintenance over here? The new, you know, if you're evacuating from this area, this is the route you need to take and how to handle it. So just kind of being aware of that. The other ones I think I do find important to add that you find out in the evacuation drill is signage and of like going, this is where your muster point is, this is how to go. So that when someone is doing the drill and they totally blank on what they're supposed to do, or it's a big facility and you don't really know the closest exit, having signs or at least knowing where it's at on a map, it's very useful.
Yeah. Having maps posted in a lot of places, or just big placards where there's a muster station, or if this building is designated as a safe shelter, if you have those next to the doorway, people coming and going, you know, it'll jog their memories like, oh yeah, that's right, I forgot that this building is my safe shelter as they're going in. And then they realize, okay, well, if the drill goes off while I'm in here, I'm good because I'm in the right place already.
Yeah. And just having different plans for different locations sometimes is nice. I've seen it before where it's just saying, hey, if you're on this side of the plant, you should be going to this shelter over here because it's the quickest one. And just being aware of that. Or if you're in, let's say, like a section that's full of trailers, and you know, those aren't very strong against natural hazards.
No.
Having a muster point or at least a designated point for those guys to get to it is important as well.
Right. If you've got a facility that's designated specific buildings for specific overpressure quantities, for instance, if you need shelter during a startup or something like that, should a incident occur, a explosion or something like that. Those may be suitable also for your safe shelters for a natural hazard like a tornado or something like that, because they are designed for overpressure.
Yeah. Here's a question for you. This is sometimes people find it not ridiculous, but they get annoyed with it. But doing an MLC when you add a temporary workspace on site.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen some people get annoyed with it because they have to sign off on it. But
you should definitely need to, because you need to make sure that if it is in a zone where it could be subject to an overpressure event, say if you lost containment during a startup or a shutdown and you had an explosion, you need to understand where that overpressure could occur, and you don't want a temporary trailer in there where somebody's going to be working and they could be killed. So yes, you definitely need to have those MOCs for those temporary buildings, even though they might not be there for long.
Yeah, no, I always get the kickback, but it doesn't change the process or change the P&ID. But it's like, no, it's not because of the process or P&ID. It's more evaluating the hazards if something were to go wrong.
Exactly. Yeah, the MOCs cover your changes to facilities in addition to changes to your process. And that's the piece that ropes those in.
Yeah. Yep. Last question for you about this topic. Do you think doing a lot of drills will lead to complacency, or do you think it would help? So we talked about hearing a lot of tornado warnings, or no, tornado watches, you know, just seeing that on the news, and sometimes getting that annoying high-pitched sound on the TV or radio to let you know there's a tornado watch.
Yeah, I don't know on that. I think, unfortunately, people's responses may be different, whether they're at work or at home. Probably not best practice. If you hear a warning, regardless of where you're at, you should take action. But I do know from a personal standpoint, a lot of times people get tired of those alarms. I know I had a situation just a month or two ago here in the St. Louis area where we had the sirens go off. And so I trooped down to the basement, and as soon as I sat down in the basement, the sirens quit. I'm like, oh, okay, well, I guess I can go back upstairs and work on dinner. And then about 2 minutes later, the sirens went off again. So I trooped back down to the basement a second time, and again, the sirens turned off after a couple minutes. And that went on about three or four times over the course of half an hour.
You got your steps in.
Yeah, so I can see a lot of times people get frustrated with that, and they can get complacent and say, it hasn't been a big deal. Maybe I'll ignore it. But that's probably not what you should be doing.
No, I totally agree. I think, at least for the tornado that occurred here back in April, I think there was some complacency that went on, because I think, I don't know how it was in St. Louis, but here in Kansas, we don't see tornadoes often. We hear their sirens all the time.
Right.
So I think a lot of people were out and about watching the tornado instead of actually following the drills we, you know, grew up learning what to
do. Stay away from the windows.
Stay away from those, find the interior, you know, part of the house or the building. Mm-hmm. Because if you go on YouTube or Google it, I'm sure you'll find a lot of video of people filming their tornadoes. But I do believe people may get complacent with it, with all the, you know, the sirens and the drills. But I think when you do it a lot, especially growing up in the, at least in Tornado Alley or the Midwest, you know what you need to do. So everyone is able to find shelter immediately or get to shelter immediately to, you know, kind of hunker down and be in a safe location. Because looking at the data from that tornado back in April, there was no fatalities. I think 3 people got injured, but for where it went through a major part of a town, to have that little of an injury or kind of bad consequences, it's good to see. So like you said, I don't know if there's a right or wrong answer, but just kind of seeing, at least in my area, everyone's watching tornadoes and we haven't, knock on wood, you know, still won't have any injuries, but I think it is useful, even though people do may act complacent to it, but when they see, you can see your tornado. So when you see the hazard coming at you, you know what to go. It might not be the case in every situation, but, or maybe it comes down to it. We were just lucky back in April. So who knows? But yeah, so when you hear events about these natural disasters, tornadoes, hurricanes, earthquakes, you know, are they results of good planning or is it just some good luck that occurred over the years? Hopefully it's mostly good planning over the years and experience and learning from those. What are your thoughts or opinion about it, about this topic? Shoot us an email and let us know. Or if you have any of your prior experience with such natural disasters or natural hazards and would like to share it with us, reach out to us at podcast@amplifyconsultants.com. Let us know.
Yeah. Yeah, we've also got another podcast from a while ago, episode 26, that covered some natural hazard assessments and planning. That one happened after Hurricane Harvey down in the Houston area where they had a lot of flooding from hurricanes. So that has a little bit different take on natural hazard assessments. And finally, our goal at Amplify Process Safety is to save lives by partnering with companies that handle highly hazardous chemicals to create world-class process safety systems. And it's our firm belief that these systems will help prevent catastrophic incidents like fires, explosions, and toxic releases. So please don't hesitate to reach out to us if we can help guide you on your process safety journey. Thanks for listening, and until next time, be safe out there.
We appreciate you joining us for this episode of Amplify Your Process Safety. Head to our website, amplifyconsultants.com, to find our show notes and other resources. Thank you for joining us in our mission to ultimately save lives by advancing process safety right here on Amplify Your Process Safety. Until next time.